At the close of the meeting, Representative Mike Coletta proposed an amendment to a resolution proposed by Fairbanks North Star Borough Mayor John Carlson. That resolution had requested that the governor continue the operation of the task force with the charge of overseeing the implementation of their objectives. The amendment requested that the governor join the task force with the Legislative Gas Pipeline Finance Committee as a subcommittee of that group. Ben Harding describes what transpired.
It was really, you know, a very right at the tail end of the meeting, and everyone was sitting there when it was broached, thinking furiously of, you know, the pros and the cons mm-hmm. and whatnot. But everyone decided that, you know, that it definitely offered a number of advantages, including already existing staffing, access to legislative funding in that area, access to legislative information. Everyone was sitting there thinking very furiously about it in those last few minutes when that proposal was made. Also, it has the advantage, from our standpoint at least, of directly bringing in the number of legislators involved yeah. in this area into this particular local use or in-state use type of scenario.
Now it's up to Hammond, who will review the preliminary report of the Blue Ribbon Working Group. According to Harding, the prognostication calls for a favorable reaction.
Now, his special assistant had indicated earlier that the governor basically felt that any strong recommendation or proposals that came from the task force surely would be something that, you know, that he could follow through on. And since they were all unanimous, I guess that's pretty strong.
Fairbanks Community Information Officer Ben Harding. I'm Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. There were two marathon races in Fairbanks this past weekend. One of them is still going on, in fact. The one that's over is the well-known Equinox Marathon, a 26-mile, 385-yard foot race considered the second toughest in the country. That was won in record time by now two-time winner Bob Murphy, a 27-year-old schoolteacher. And in the same race, a 12-year-old girl, Mara Rabinowitz, set the women's record for the course. There are some other kids racing right now, and they're also out to set a record in the Guinness Book of Records. These kids, some as young as four, including a petite little six-year-old girl nicknamed Muscles, are members of swim teams, and they are out to swim 800 miles nonstop, hoping to do it in 8 days. Why 800 miles? Three reasons. One, the previous marathon swimming record is 600 miles. Two, they hope to make money to purchase needed equipment and to send swimmers to competitions. And three, it's the distance of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. That's right, the oil pipeline that stretches from Prudhoe Bay in the north to Valdez in the south. No, they're not actually entering the line itself and crawling through the black muck, though that might really make for a good story. You know, National Enquirer style, parents watch as coach pushes screaming 8-year-old into, and you know the rest. Two local swim clubs, the Stingrays and the Arctic Swim Club, each symbolically beginning at one end of the line, are swimming either down or up to Fairbanks in the middle. One representative from each group must be in the water at all times, day and night, in order for the record to be valid. Their progress is represented by a map on one side of the pool showing the pipeline. As they progress toward Fairbanks, the map will be filled in with black, representing oil. The event is the brainstorm of Stingray coach Harriet Dial, who doesn't see the pipeline swim as the ultimate challenge of a marathon relay swim. Nope, she's already got her sights on next year and a try, again figuratively, at swimming the Yukon River, and that's 1,500 miles. As it is, even swimming, say, half a mile is no small feat. I spoke with several of the young swimmers as they emerged red-eyed from the pool, but one 12-year-old's eyes were redder than most. How do you feel now?
Tired.
How do you expect you're going to feel at the end of 8 days?
Probably go home and just sleep for 1,000 years.
Well, who knows? Maybe that tired 12-year-old with the red eyes will wake up after all, in time for next year's race. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. Bob Larson, Delta Area game biologist for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, reported today that, contrary to farmers' fears, there has been little crop damage due to incursions of the hairy bison, that is, buffalo. Apparently, the crop depredation that has occurred, and the barley harvest is still underway, has been largely due to the big animals rolling and trampling the grain rather than eating it. Although Larson did admit that if all the barley eaten by the bison were put into one pile, it would amount to quite a bit, or quite a bite at any rate. It seems the bison, like humans, take quite a fancy to the grain. When their feed dries up, they move down into the fields. They find the barley so appealing as feed that biologist Larson refers to it as an, quote, ice cream plant. So it seems that the buffalo's affinity for good protein and farmers' fears of massive depredation isn't such a bunch of barloney after all. And the bad puns don't stop here. Larson feels that the only solution to the barley-bison conflict is for farmers to construct fences around their crops. In the interim, or for farmers who would rather not put out the expense required, the department responds to buffalo calls to deal with the problem of the bisana non grata, to borrow a phrase from game biologist Dave Johnson. The department shoos the animals off, sometimes with a gas-powered device called a Zahn cannon. Only problem is the animals are getting used to it. So much for Pavlov, or maybe the sound will trigger stampedes to the fields. You know, oh boy, there's that big blast, must be chow time, or some such animalistic utterance. Does Larson feel that farmers would be justified in killing a munching buffalo? They are trespassing, after all. No, he doesn't. He feels that, to the contrary, it's the buffalo's natural range, and unlike human intruders, the buffalo has the right to be there. But maybe not. Prehistorically, bison preceded human inhabitation of the Delta area, but the present bison were actually imported in the 1930s from Wyoming. So who does have the right to be there, man, or rather persons, or beast? In some ways, it would seem that people have the upper hand. On September 17th, buffalo hunting season opened, and permits were issued for 25 of the animals. Depreciating the herd, estimated at 300 bison by 1/12, will not help this year's harvest, barley harvest, that is, and it may not have much impact on next year's either. Larson does feel, though, that hunting pressure is an effective means of moving the animals from one area to another. But in order for that hunting to be an effective means of moving the animals, that is, in the desired direction, the hunting would have to occur at the time of the barley harvest. And then, to avoid further aggravation to farmers who did not want hunters on their land, Fish and Game would have to guide the hunts, as they have in the past, said Larson, quote, "That very well may happen if we have to take more than 20 or 25 bison next year." And what would that cost? He didn't know, but doubted that it would exceed funds now being spent for the Zahn guns and for having department personnel shoo the animals away from those no-trespassing signs put up by the farmers. So it will be a while before we really know just whose home it is when we hear that cowboy classic, "Home, Home on the Range." I'm Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.
Let me into your life. Let me share what I see. That's what I'd like to do.
Sounds kind of corny? Sounds like something you maybe heard before? Well, yes and no. It is schmaltzy, but chances are you haven't heard it. It's from a production in progress, Alaska the Musical.
You can count on me.
The show, which is about two-thirds singing and one-third talking, is the brainchild of Doug Herring, former Alaskan, who left the state for Hawaii and later Los Angeles, where he learned about the business of producing a Broadway show.
Alaska is the story of some individuals, some Alaskans who decide to tackle the overgrowth of the government, the federal government, out of control regulations, and it's about the spirit of these individuals and what they do about it in this period of time. The story takes place in three time periods: the year 2000, in which is the time period that the show opens. It is taking a look back from a turn of the century celebration back to what these certain Alaskans did, and the people of Alaska did, to inspire people in the rest of the country to take a look at what's going on and to start doing something about it in the 1980s. So it's basically about people getting out from under controls and realizing that the government we have is a service organization that we have hired to do service for us. We'd like to do a number now that is one of the dance numbers in the year 2000 at the celebration, a number called Space Jazz.
Herring recently returned to Alaska to fine-tune, as he says, the show. He and a troupe of musicians and dancers, some Alaskan, others from New York and Seattle, have been touring urban areas of the state, playing samples of the show, accompanied by a large slide screen showing various nature, people scenes, and occasional drawings by designer Reinhold Sommersted of proposed sets for the production. The production itself spans the years from 1960 to the year 2000. Even some of the t-shirts promoting the musical sport flashing lights, LEDs in the shape of the Big Dipper, symbolic of Alaska's flag. It may be the technology of the late 1970s, but is it the look of 2000? During intermission of a show before a Fairbanks audience who had paid $20 each to sip wine and eat cheese and melons, I asked members of the audience, a mixed group of legislators, business people, members of the arts communities, and people who looked more like they'd ordinarily prefer another environment, for their reactions to the production. This is the ladies' bathroom report, is that correct?
Yes, rated C, and then the music was good.
I love the idea of about a musical about Alaska.
I like the songs that poke fun at government and at other institutions.
What I expected was the dancing and the pizzazz of a big-time show.
And did you get that?
Absolutely.
I knew what I was coming for. I knew it was a promotional thing.
And you felt you got what you came for?
I got a promotional scheme.
After the show, I asked Doug Herring how he felt the evening, which cost him $3,800 in expenses just for the hotel and catering, had gone.
I feel really good. I mean, the reception was phenomenal.
Getting some backing?
I think so. I mean, we're getting a lot of interest. You don't actually get it out of these concerts. You get contacts. You get people who want to get together and talk, you know. What we're looking for as far as the budget for the show is not necessarily just coming from people who are throwing nickels and dimes, you know.
Alaska the Musical. For now, it's t-shirts and promotional tours. But will it be Broadway? Well, stay tuned.
It's in Alaska. Alaska's our home.
Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. Sig Ween, 75-year-old brother of the founder of Ween Air Alaska and former chairman and president of the airline, recently sold all of his stock, in excess of 9% of the company's total, to Household Finance Corporation for $6.50 a share. While declining to comment on why he sold or the fairness of the price, he did state that he would miss the airline with which he had been associated since 1934, but it certainly was no case of a broken heart.
Well, I can get along without it. You know, I had a long, long career in it, and it was satisfying. And I can get along without it.
Ween had been a bush pilot for 15 or 20 years before directing his efforts toward administration. After such a long and varied involvement in a field in which he had seen many changes, did he plan to look for other ventures?
No, I'm not looking for other ventures, really. I don't aspire to, you know, set the world on fire or anything like that.
Although retired for several years, Ween had remained on the board of directors. Now that he no longer held a position on the board, did he have any real retirement plans? Plans for a long vacation, perhaps?
No, just perhaps an occasional vacation trip.
One wonders if these trips will be on the airline that bears Sig Ween's family name. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. At a 2.5-hour meeting last night, a committee composed of 2 members of the City Council and 3 members of the Borough Assembly solicited suggestions from members of the community regarding proposals for projects that might fit under guidelines for a potential $1 million of housing and urban development funds, $500,000 earmarked for the city and the other $500,000 for the borough. Guidelines for the grant program, called the Small Cities Community Development Block Program, state that the program is competitive. That is, the city and borough will be competing for funds with other eligible communities. Regulations state that projects must address specific aims: the expansion of low and moderate income housing opportunities, promotion of the deconcentration of low income housing, providing increased economic opportunities for low and moderate income people, correction of deficiencies that affect public health or safety, especially for people with low and moderate incomes, and promoting rational land use. Nancy Webb, Borough Grants Administrator, describes some of the ideas proposed at last night's hearing.
Housing came up many times. Mm-hmm. So people seem to be interested in energy conservation and housing in general. But there were also some very good proposals for some of our more public service organizations in town. A proposal for a rehabilitation center for people coming out of prison. Mm-hmm. A proposal for some kind of housing, temporary housing for women in town from Salvation Army people. Mm. And then, of course, WICA, Women in Crisis Counseling, suggests that we really need a bigger facility for battered women and their children.
Although the hearings were both for city and borough HUD proposals, the two government units will submit separate pre-applications due by October 15th, though they will complement each other. Both are likely to focus on one area, Webb explains.
This would really convince the federal officials that we are doing our best to work together as units of government on a common problem. And ideally, I think it'll be housing of some sort, a program of housing that will show that we are, in fact, working together on a common problem.
Is the situation unusual since there is a borough-city separation?
I think it's unusual to the feds, yeah. I think that they're used to one municipality that does these things. And in fact, even in the state of Alaska, places like Juneau and Anchorage have an easier time, I think, in getting these programs going, especially like rehab, because they have one municipality that can handle everything. And in the case here in Fairbanks, we have a second-class borough and a home rule city within it. And it turns out that if the borough wants to do rehab outside the city, we're going to have a special election.
Since it will probably be housing and not rehab that the city and borough propose to HUD officials, no such election will be necessary. But it's not necessarily due to citizen testimony or preference that the emphasis will be on housing. Although funding guidelines call for public participation, elected officials are not bound to follow those suggestions. Webb, however, feels that should not present a problem.
I have no doubt that elected officials are responsive in this case, and they will take into account very seriously what came into the hearing.
Nancy Webb, Grants Administrator for the Fairbanks North Star Borough. I'm Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. About 24 people, few of them from rural areas, attended a conference today on the role of the federal government in rural education. The meeting, held at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks, was one of a series of conferences held in 11 locations nationwide. Alaska, because of its size and location, is having its own conference rather than participating by region. The meeting, chaired by Alan Apodaca, Region 10 Commissioner for Education Programs, stems from a national seminar on rural education held at the University of Maryland in late May of this year. That meeting considered 21 prepared position papers on the subject, and a list of 28 recommendations were derived. The group in Fairbanks, like the groups present at the other 10 regional gatherings, will discuss and amend those points. Ultimately, reports from the 11 regional meetings will be compiled into one report submitted to the U.S. Office of Education. The 28 recommendations are grouped into areas: equity and quality for rural education, linking rural development and rural education, delivery of services to rural education, data collection and research, vocational and career training, and energy and rural education. Apodaca explains why the meetings are being held.
The growing concern by both the U.S. Office of Education and the Congress about the inequities of resources that are transmitted to rural areas.
The potential areas for further federal involvement are ostensibly reflected in the 28 recommendations. The gist of federal concern is set forth in the preamble to the body of the report explaining the points, quote, "A national policy of rural development is long past due." Alaska, of course, has in the past few years been leaning away from federal involvement in education and toward increased local control, a view bound to be expressed by the participants in today's conference. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. Though the meeting was called to discuss recommendations on potential areas for involvement of the federal government in rural education, Alaskans attending the conference were wary of that premise. Of the 24 or so present for the day-long session, most of them were admitted bureaucrats and few were actually residents of the target group being discussed. Both Thelma Langdon, chairperson of the State Board of Education, and State Commissioner of Education Marshall Lind expressed their reservations about the lack of Bush participation. First we'll hear Ms. Langdon and then Commissioner Lind.
I hope that whatever comes out of this is helpful and puts us in a real positive direction in rural education without making it ever more cumbersome, as could very possibly happen.
As the Commissioner of Education for the State of Alaska, what do you feel should be the role of the federal government in rural education?
Well, quite frankly, limited. That's kind of our general feeling about the role of federal government in education, period, because it's a responsibility reserved for the states.
Early in the meeting, several prominent educators queried Region 10 Commissioner of Education Alan Apodaca and his assistant George Swift about the lack of grassroots input. Where were the rural people the meeting was to address? No funds were provided by the U.S. Office of Education for travel or per diem into Fairbanks, and with the exception of the Yukon Flats School District, rural education attendance area representatives were non-native administrative personnel. asked if Apodaca would be doing something to address the lack of villagers in reviewing the recommendations up for discussion, he responded that supplemental mailings could be sent out and the responses collated later in Seattle. By mid-meeting, some of the sentiment had changed. Nina Russell from the Yukon Flats School Board said that at first she felt it wasn't right that there weren't more Native people involved, but as the meeting progressed, she decided the people in attendance knew quite a bit about the matters under discussion, and while they may have expressed themselves differently, they had the good of rural areas at heart. Asked how he felt about the lack of rural representation at the meeting, Commissioner Lind replied,
"That's very disturbing. You could get the typical bureaucrats like myself around to most any kind of meeting and a lot of the other university types and so forth. But I think that in order for the recommendations of this group to have any credibility, there better be some more representation from the communities directly affected by the non-bureaucrats, non-professional educators. And I think that's very important. And if anything, maybe they'll have to have another go at this."
The recommendations themselves were marked by a definite bias, a bias reflective of quite a different environment from Alaska. Ann Just, a consultant for Alaska Legal Services and Rural CAP, who is currently on leave from the U.S. Office of Education, said that she felt the group was modifying those points.
"I feel that they are to reflect the Alaska input, and it's not just the Alaska input, which is extremely important in this particular meeting, but the recommendations seem to have primarily a farm state Caucasian bias, and there are a lot of non-farm states in this country with lots of other populations, other ethnic groups, Native American migrant workers, and I think those concerns, not deliberately, not maliciously, were not necessarily addressed, or definitely were not addressed in the College Park meeting, and I begin to see, which is heartening about this meeting, and while I'm glad to see the people are working the way they are, to get some of those concerns voiced and incorporated into the recommendations through the modifications that are being suggested here."
Perhaps ironically, several of the 28 recommendations being discussed concerned the utilization of technology in the delivery of services for rural education. The meeting itself might have benefited from the use of technology. Teleconferencing, for example, may have enabled more people without the personal funds to travel to Fairbanks, to have their input into the discussions. According to Just, recently returned from Washington, D.C., funds could have been obtained to enlarge the access to the Fairbanks conference for such things as teleconferencing and subregional meetings, said Just.
"If somebody had really been honchoing what was going on in the Washington, D.C. level at the end of the fiscal year with the finances that were available, we could have really done something that was very exciting."
It will be some time before the modifications to the recommendations from the 11 meetings nationwide are compiled. Then, the effect of a lack of genuine rural input can be more accurately assessed. In the interim, there's plenty of news on the education front to follow with the creation of the new cabinet-level Department of Education. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.